Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com, or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm very good. I've had a good week, and I hope you have as well.
Having a very good week. The one downer is every time you go outside, you around here you smell smoke, and you look up north and see the haze and know that the fire we talked about last week is nowhere near being out. You and I were just talking before the show started. It's now ranked as the most destructive wildfire in Colorado history. So we're still tracking that one, sadly, and looking for some resolution in the near future. The weather changed significantly today. It clouded up and it cooled off quite a bit, but at this point we're gonna need some significant rain, I think, to really make a difference.
I hope that you guys get it and get it soon and in great quantities, and help get that fire out. I know that it's costly, it's dangerous. People have lost their lives in this fire, I believe. And
they absolutely have. I mean, people are losing their homes, they're losing their livestock, and unfortunately, a few folks have lost their lives. There's also, just terrible health risks associated with all that smoke in the air. It's one of the worst things, especially people who work outdoors, especially nearer to the area where the fire is going on. It's just it's a bad situation all the way around. And yes, looking forward to some good news on that front. We hope in the very near future.
Excellent. Well, it's been an interesting week for science, hasn't it? We have a couple of pretty big stories to talk about tonight.
Well, we do indeed. Do you want to start with the Higgs boson?
Yeah, let's do that. This has kind of been like a story that's been brewing, quite some time. I guess it was postulated, the Higgs boson particle was postulated by the Standard Model, which, Phil, you're a better man than I if you can tell me exactly when that paper was published that talked about the Standard Model. I think it was in the 90s.
That sounds about right to me. I'm not that much better of a man. I don't have my notes in front of me, so I can't tell you off the top of my head. But we did a full show about this when was it March? There was a big flap that we were on the verge of discovering the Higgs boson. We talked about the role it plays, the key role it plays in setting out this standard model of the universe. It's kind of the missing piece of the puzzle. And now, what, somebody saw one? What actually happened here? What has occurred?
Okay, the Higgs boson particle, by the way, is the particle in the standard model. If the standard model is correct, it would be the particle that gives mass to all other particles in the universe. Okay, it's the mass giver. And obviously that would be an important part of the universe, right? Well, we had never confirmed the existence of it. We got a hint when we did our program a few months ago that there appears to be in the place that they would, think that they could find it, the right frequency or whatever, strong evidence that it was there. But apparently you know, there's a certain number of standard deviations they have to have in order for it to meet the rigorousness that's accepted in science for having said that we found it, okay?
Right.
And so apparently they had basically a 2 sigma, they had it down to like 2 sigma, which apparently meant it was something like just 14% chance at a 2 sigma that it was just a big coincidence. You know, all these different observations that it was only a 14% chance that it was a coincidence, and they you know, that's pretty strong, right?
That's an 86% chance that it's actually the Higgs boson.
Exactly. That's what they had way back in, you know, a few months ago, right? Well, the rumor, and it's a pretty strong rumor, it's coming from a number of sources, is that they've now gotten it down to 4 sigma. That and now we're talking fractions of a percent possibility that it's all just bunk, okay?
Oh, okay.
But it's still not – they have to – you know, in order for them to announce, hey, we got it, they want to reach 5 sigma. And so, you know, I would expect that we often hear, you know, within just a short period of time, because what they're doing, Phil, is that they're crunching data from 2 different colliders and comparing them. And so, you know, having reached this point, I think that they can probably nail it down to 5 sigma, you know, maybe just within a short period of time. And so I fully expect to hear that. You know, they've got it. And now, you know, here's the thing. I would like to know, you know, what does that mean? Once they, you know that the Higgs, you know, we got the Higgs boson particle, that pretty much confirms the standard model, because that's all the particles that we would, you know, that they were expecting to find, I believe. This was the last one.
Right.
And so what does that do to improve our understanding of the universe? What, you know, I've got, you know, my kids are going, yeah, you know, all we need then is to figure out a way to turn off the, a Higgs boson compensator, and then you can have, you know, the floating skateboard from Back to the Future.
Exactly,
that's a science fiction-y thing that we would like to see. But here in the real world, I'd like to know what some scientist thinks that this knowledge will do for us. I've not come across anyone going out on a limb to say what that would really mean for us. So,
it's an interesting thing, because on the one hand, it's this huge discovery. On the other hand, all it really does is confirm a model that we all accept anyway. Right?
Right.
I mean, the standard model is not
so
in
much.
Doubt. There's not a big competing model. So it's not like Higgs boson is winning out over some other particle that explains some other model.
There is a competing model. It's just not accepted by too many serious, you know.
Sure.
Scientists.
Yeah. You know what I mean? It's not like everyone's standing with bated breath to see which model is going to win out, right?
They call it the standard model for a reason.
Exactly. So on the one hand, it's very important. On the other hand, it lacks that kind of drama, and I think it does have a certain arcane nature to it. That when you start talking about something like the Higgs boson, like, okay, well, we can all sleep easier tonight knowing that we really do have mass, right? Well, we knew we had mass anyway, right? You know what I mean?
maybe a little more than I would like, but
exactly, yeah. You know, that's, I don't really take all that much solace in having mass, but actually confirmation of that model. Any thing that starts out as a mathematical formula, that starts out as when I crunch the numbers, it says this should exist, and then we go out and actually locate that thing, that's a big deal. I mean, that's really what science is all about. Also, it's a big deal when you go out and then it turns out the thing's not there. Also a big deal, right? I mean, if we had never found the Higgs boson, that would have been huge too, because then the standard model would have had to have been revised, and suddenly we know more about the universe than we did before. So it's one of those things that the fact that the universe is showing us something that we calculated earlier about the universe is just, you know, your son's on the right track, man. This is just a very exciting thing in its own right. And I think eventual potential technological applications of the Higgs boson are shouldn't be completely discounted. They do sound awfully science fictiony, but then the Higgs boson itself sounds really weird to us too. You know, the particle that accounts for the fact that there's mass, that just sounds weird. I mean, you think of mass as being this property, not as being like a component part of all matter, but in a sense it is, you know, and it's like we found the mass component, here it is. Now what? Well, is there an anti-Higgs boson, right? Or, you know, to your point, is there a Higgs boson dampener or compensator or something like that? Maybe not, but it speaks to a whole kind of technology that exists right now only in fantasy, only in science fiction. But we're one step closer now to something as wacky as that actually becoming reality. And who knows, to sneak preview the end of our show this evening, something like that, something like technology that leverages our understanding of the Higgs boson might well be the key to practical interstellar travel at some point. We'll see.
And, you know, obviously we hope so. You know, it is the sort of thing. Well, and let's think just real briefly. There is a connection between what Einstein was, you know, formulating in his what he was doing back in the early 20th century, and the electronics age. I mean, much of what he was doing at that point laid the groundwork for what they were able to do later with computers, and you know, not just the atom bomb. You know, a lot of people, you know, connect what he was doing with that, and you know, it's perhaps a little more obvious, the connection. But it was not just that. It was he was, you know, because of what he did, there was the theoretical framework for computers that came along not long after that. So who knows what finding the Higgs boson will reveal to us at some point. It might not be something that is just right away, just right around the corner. It might be on down the road. So, anyway,
could very well be. Yeah,
it's exciting.
We'll see. You know, live to see it. That's the that's the way I like to look at these things. Speaking of living to see it, you know what is significant about today? Do you not, Mister Calendar, with all the holidays, right?
It is the summer solstice today. It was 6 o'clock my time. I guess that would be 5 o'clock your time.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
It was officially summer, and so that's pretty cool.
That is remarkable.
I considered it summer for quite some time, but yeah, today is the first official day.
Well, first we want to say for all of our listeners in the Southern Hemisphere, this is actually the winter solstice, and it's the beginning of winter. So enjoy. I was having a conversation. I was getting my hair cut earlier, actually, and this whole conversation was going on. People were saying, how's your summer going? Are you enjoying your summer? And finally I said, you know, today is actually the first day of summer. And they were like, oh, yeah, I guess it is. Isn't it tomorrow? And we got into this thing about, no, it's a leap year, so it's today and not it's the 20th and not the 21st. And I said, yeah, this is, you know, the longest day of the year. And the lady who was cutting my hair goes, well, I can believe that. I'm pulling a 12-hour shift.
That's great. I love that.
I thought that summed it up pretty nicely. Yeah. You know, I'm sitting here thinking about astronomy and the tilt and the North Pole is facing the closest to the sun and all that kind of stuff. And you know, she explained longest day in terms that anyone can understand, right? It's like
that's great. I love that.
having to cut heads and listen to people like me blather on for 12 hours. That's her. that makes for the longest.
She may have been telling you that you're making her day feel longer already. But
exactly. Sally points out that the longest day was actually June 6, 1944. Great.
Great reference movie there, Sally. That was a long movie.
Indeed it is. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the other big scientific development that has occurred this week, and that one has to do with a spacecraft, a space probe that was launched back in 1977. That's Voyager 1, and the big news is that Voyager has passed, or is in the process of passing, or will soon pass into interstellar space. The the Voyager 1 craft is now 11.1 billion miles away from the Earth, and it's about to pass out of the heliosphere into, I don't know what you call this area, I guess it's just called interstellar space, but essentially it will be in an area where it's no longer surrounded by radiation from our sun, but rather cosmic radiation. It's like that's the difference. This is kind of the, you know, speaking of kind of arcane things here, this is the distinction that the NASA scientists are making. The telemetry that they're getting back shows a lot less solar radiation and a lot more cosmic radiation. And eventually we're going to hit a cusp where it's not reading any more solar radiation, and what it's reading is just these cosmic rays, and that's going to mean it's all over. You're no longer under the you're out of our solar system. You're completely out of our system, and you're out into Star Trek type space, as I was explaining it the other day. You know, the kind of space they go across in the science fiction movies. So this is big. You know, it's getting a little bit of media attention, but I don't think it's getting quite the media attention that it deserves. And I think one reason that it's not is because the impact of it isn't completely understood. I think there's another reason, we'll get to that in a few minutes, which has to do with how we define these terms. But generally, I don't think people are aware of how big of a step this is. And Stephen, I think you would agree that this is one of the biggest things that's ever occurred.
Well, absolutely. We have reached a time, right, you know, as of, I suppose, this week, if based on how you want to count it. But as of this week, there's now a man-made object that has left the solar system. That has never happened before. We did not live in a world like that last week, and we live in that world now. And it is a big deal. It's you know, for one thing, they're learning about interstellar space for the first time, firsthand. They're learning, you know, they had an idea of what kind of radiation is outside the solar system, but they're beginning to understand, you know, wow, this, you know, it's a lot. Apparently, the heliosphere protects our solar system from, you know, there's a lot of radiation coming from our sun, but apparently that solar wind is keeping cosmic radiation, which is much stronger, out of the solar system. And, you know, and we're learning how big of a deal that is. That's apparently, you know, if there's enough radiation outside the solar system that it would be impossible for life to develop under those circumstances, as we know it, at any rate.
Right.
Life as we know it. So that's, it's, you know, we're learning firsthand those things. That's a big deal. The accomplishment of actually getting there is a big deal. And here we are just a few short years from having left Earth at all. Now leaving the solar system, so it's a pretty big deal. Pretty big deal.
I remember when Apollo 11 landed. When the craft actually landed, someone in the coverage, I assume it was Walter Cronkite, because it seems like that's who we were watching. Looking back, I was very young at the time, by the way. Watching this on TV, noted that Kitty Hawk, the invention of the airplane, had just occurred in 1903. And so 66 years had elapsed between the first manned heavier-than-air flight and a human being landing on the moon. 66 years. Amazing achievement. And, you know, one of the great examples of just rapid, you know, discontinuous accelerating change in a sphere outside of information technology, I think. But I would submit that what we're seeing here is even bigger. If we run a similar time scale and go from Sputnik, which was in 1957, to Voyager passing out of the solar system and into interstellar space in 2012, am I doing the math right? That's
something like 55
years, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. Yeah, it's 55 years.
Okay, so like 11 years less, and arguably a bigger leap.
Right.
The difference being there's not a person involved, right? We didn't send a human being out into interstellar space. because that would be a one-way trip, and we don't do those things. But this is a much farther horizon to cross, and a much less likely one that we ever would have. I think I believe that when the engineers and the technicians who put Voyager 1 together, when they built that craft, they had contingencies where maybe even, 30, 40 years later, it would still be sending back data and we'd hear something from it even as it passed out into interstellar space. But I'm not sure anyone really believed that was ever going to happen, right, that this day would ever come. It's so...
And still be transmitting.
Yeah, still putting out a signal. I mean, well, that's the difference. That's the distinction with the other spacecraft that we don't talk about as much, the probes that we've kind of forgotten about, Pioneer 10 and 11, which Pioneer was originally credited with passing out of the solar system back when we had a much more provincial definition of the solar system than we do today. In 1983, it went out past the orbit of Pluto, and it is still proceeding along. It's going in a different direction from Voyager, but there's several issues there, why aren't we celebrating Pioneer instead of Voyager? The big one is Voyager is going faster, and eventually it passed Pioneer, so it is truly outside of the heliosphere before anything else. Pioneer didn't make that leap, but more importantly and sadly, it finally gave up the ghost in terms of being able to send us data back in about 2003. The last confirmed message came about 9 years ago from Pioneer. And that was astounding that we got, that we were continuing to get information from Pioneer even at that point. It's an amazing accomplishment how much we learned from these sets of probes. But it has not made it as far, and we'll never know now. I mean, unless we go after it with something faster, we're never going to know what happens to Pioneer, because it's not sending us any data back. How much longer we'll be hearing from Voyager, who knows? I would venture to guess it's already well past its expected performance lifespan. But, on the other hand, it might be another 10, might be another 20 years. It could be... it could be 15 billion miles out there before we stop hearing from it. And who knows what additional information it might give us between now and then.
Yeah, it's there's this idea that the heliosphere, is pushing up against this cosmic, radiation, and that it actually makes a bow shock. And so, I wonder if Voyager can possibly survive hitting, it's not just, normal cosmic radiation, but it's like cosmic radiation bunched up against the bow of the heliosphere. If that
right.
makes sense. And so it, I just wonder if Voyager can possibly survive that. And obviously, I very much would like for it to, and be able to continue to send back information. It has, I believe, it's, the question is, when we're dealing with cell phones that we have to charge daily, and cars that, you have a pretty big battery on that, it'll only last a season or two, a year or two, a good car battery. What exactly is powering Voyager? My understanding is it's an atomic battery.
That's right.
It's atomic decay is creates electricity, and that's what they're using to power this thing. And so those things have a useful life for obviously multiple decades. And glad it's got a good Energizer bunny on that bill. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, a battery that works far better than we ever could have hoped that it would work, and this is a great opportunity to look back on those programs and recognize how significant their contribution has been to our understanding of our solar system. You think about before Voyager and before Pioneer, how little we knew about things that we kind of take for granted now. When I was a kid, they could only aim telescopes at Saturn. The theory was that ring was a bunch of little particles, but nobody could say for sure that it was maybe rocks or something like that. And now you think about these vivid, up close, particularly with some of the later probes, but originally with Voyager, pictures showing, oh, this is what the ring of a planet looks like. We didn't know. All we had was the theory, and then suddenly we had these incredible images of Saturn and of Jupiter. You know those first images we ever saw of Uranus and Neptune, and learning that that Saturn wasn't the only planet with a ring, learning that there were a lot more moons out there than we ever realized, and finally, ultimately, learning that Pluto was so different from what we thought it was that it got demoted as a planet. These are the pieces of equipment, I guess, that made it possible to learn all that stuff. And it's really a different solar system we live in now than we lived in before those craft were launched. And I was just looking at the Wikipedia page. I got to thinking, what exactly does Voyager do? You know, it's sending us all this information. What did it do? What does it do? And I was looking at this table of the different systems that run Voyager. The first one, and the one we're most familiar with, is the imaging science system. Basically, it was the camera, right? It was taking pictures, and it was showing images back. That one has now been disabled. There was a radio system, which was looking at the atmospheres, ionospheres, gravity fields, all in the radio wavelength, now disabled. The infrared interferometer spectrometer was looking at the energy balance and atmospheric composition of those planets, now disabled. There was the ultraviolet spectrometer, okay? So this was looking at atmospheric properties and to measure radiation, still running. The triaxial flux gate, which was looking at magnetic fields. You know, it was designed to look at the magnetic fields of Jupiter, but now it's out looking at the magnetic fields of deep space, still working. The plasma spectrometer was defective, never worked. Low-energy charged particle instrument, so out there looking for ions, electrons, different particles, that thing is still working and still telling us interesting things about what's out there. The cosmic ray system has been working all this time and might, as you pointed out, Stephen, have its last hurrah here when it bumps into that big bow of cosmic radiation. The planetary radio astronomy investigation system has now been shut down, but it was acting as a radio telescope while in the process of completing its mission. There was a photopolarimeter. It was a polarizer gathering information on surface texture. That one was defective. And then the plasma wave system, looking at electron density profiles, originally of Jupiter and Saturn, but now looking at space generally. So all these, you know, all these different systems, and I'll just count down the list, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of those still operating. You know, we think, well, it's astounding that it's still sending back information, but it's still gathering a lot of information, too, on a lot of different parameters. You know, they disabled the ones that aren't going to be able to provide us much more information, like the camera. You know, that's the most glamorous system on Voyager, but it makes good sense to shut that down because that was probably the biggest battery hog too. So yeah. they want to continue
what
to be able to.
There's not the same kind of images to see out there at that point.
Well, I tell you what, if you go to the Wikipedia page for Voyager, its last hurrah was the blue dot photo. Have you seen that one?
I believe so.
The pale blue dot, when it was much closer to Earth than it is now, just a mere like 4 billion miles out, they turned it around one last time, pointed it straight at Earth, and took a picture, and it's just this huge black field with this tiny, tiny blue dot in it. And it's
was that Carl Sagan's idea? I think that was.
It must have been.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, I think it was his idea that, you know, let's turn, you know, there's not much left else that it can do. Let's get a picture of the planet Earth from where it is. And he even wrote a book, I think, after that called The Pale Blue Dot.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just an incredibly iconic, poignant image of the planet. You know, we always think about the pictures from Apollo 8. The picture of Earth rise and Earth as one blue marble out in the sky, out in space, and that's a cool image, but this is kind of powerful image of Earth. This one is interesting because it's so remote, you know. It's like there's Earth, but just barely, and you're so far out. Now to think that Voyager is now nearly three times as far from us as it was then. You know, even if the camera was still working, there would be nothing to photograph. We're invisible now from where Voyager is, and we're gonna hopefully stay visible. It will stay visible to us via radio transmission for some time to come. But as you pointed out, there's one hurdle, at least one hurdle yet to be crossed. In addition to how long can the battery possibly last?
Right. I was looking here at in a picture of, basically showing just how far away it is. We are, looking at this based on, where the Earth is and where Pluto is, it looks like basically Pluto would be about only one-third of the distance to where it is now. I'm just kind of guessing based on this image in the Wikipedia article. It looks like, When it hit the orbit of Pluto, it was about one third of the distance away from us that it is today. It's just really gone a long, long way. So, congratulations to the little spacecraft that could,
Yeah, congratulations to Voyager and to everybody who made it happen. I must say.
That's right.
One of the interesting things about Voyager that I was reminded of while reading about it is this phonograph record that was embedded on the probe, the golden record.
It's another idea of Carl Sagan's, I believe. Is that right? Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. This is a message to whoever might one day find Voyager 1 or 2, and basically it's an aluminum sheath, and you open it up, and there's a record in there. It's about a 12-inch disc. It's a copper-gold alloy, so it should withstand even thousands of years in space. And it's an old, for the kids listening, we used to have phonographic records. It was an analog audio device, a disc with grooves in it that if you stuck a needle into those grooves connected to an amplifier, you could get sound out. And that's what we used to listen to back before CDs and back before MP3 players. And that was kind of state of the art of the best way to record audio information at the time that these probes were being put together. So they put this together. They just included a lot of sounds from Earth. One of the most interesting things on there is just greetings in a bunch of different languages. Not every language on Earth, but many different languages. And the one in English is a kid saying hello from the children of Earth, which is just really a very poignant sounding greeting when you hear it. And you think if someday, thousands of years from now, somebody finds that and hears it, it will mean absolutely nothing to them, but how meaningful it is to us. Unless whoever finds it is our descendant, right? Whoever finds it might well be somehow connected to our civilization, in which case perhaps the whole thing will be comprehensible. But they sent out this record with a stylus and as best they could encapsulated instructions on how to play it back. Right. So who knows? Maybe it included a message from President Carter, from Kurt Waldheim, who was at that time the General Secretary of the United Nations, and I think a few other important people. Basically a great idea.
Just a message in a bottle, kind of.
What's that?
Yeah, and think about it, it's really a time capsule as much as anything. I thought that the message from the UN president was, I thought that was pretty interesting. He said, he basically said, we're coming in peace and to teach if called upon, to be taught if fortunate enough. And I thought that was an excellent way to put that. And so it was, like you said, very poignant.
And it put me in mind of, speaking of Pioneer, and I think it's important to remember Pioneer while we're talking about this. They didn't have a record on that, but they had a plaque. Have you ever seen that picture of the plaque that went out on Pioneer?
I have, yes.
And that
isn't that the one that shows the kind of a figure of what the human is and that kind of thing?
That's right. Yeah. It's got a few things on it. First off, it's got reference to pulsars, and it's got little ticks on it showing how frequently these pulsars pulse. And if whoever finds it puts it together that this is a reference to pulsars, they can actually triangulate our position in the galaxy by the frequency of these pulsars. So it's a huge leap there, but if somebody ever finds it and goes, wait a minute, maybe it's pulsars, then they will actually be able to locate the sun. Once they locate the sun, it's got a picture of our entire solar system. Unfortunately, at the time, we thought Pluto was a planet, so it's a little misleading there. It also shows Saturn as being the only planet with a ring, so if they have really good telescopes, they're going to go, oh, wait, this can't be it. There's several planets with rings. But it shows the planet Earth with a little arrow pointing out, and then a little picture of the Pioneer spacecraft itself. Then there's a bigger relief of the Pioneer spacecraft with a human man and woman standing next to it, and the guy's got his arm up waving. Almost certainly would be completely incomprehensible to anyone who found it. I mean, one thing, critics pointed out, some people were objected to the fact that the man and woman were naked. There was also objection to that they both look kind of white and blonde as far as being representative of Earth. But the most interesting critique that I read of it was the use of the arrow symbol. You know, we automatically look at it and go, oh, there's a line pointing from here to that, and that shows me that I'm going from here to there. That might just be our assumption as humans, right? You know, we arrows have been kind of embedded into our culture all along. That might be completely incomprehensible to an alien who eventually finds it. I think an alien who finds it would look at it and go, it looks like there's two little pictures of the spacecraft, and the rest of this is absolute gibberish. That would be my... That would be my guess. Maybe they'd look at the humans and go, I don't know, those could be aliens. I'm not sure. They're strange looking creatures, though. That's for sure. If they are, but it's a great idea. As much for us as it is for the aliens, as much a statement about the fact that we understood that we were sending something elsewhere, truly elsewhere, truly outside of our own scope. Not only. Not only away from the Earth, but away from the Sun, away from everything we've ever known, and into interstellar space. So it's like we've got our first ever spacecraft passing into interstellar space. I think it's important to remember these first two kind of transmissions, these first two messages that we ever tried to send into interstellar space. So that's kind of. That's kind of the significance of Pioneer and Voyager, but you know, we're talking about on to the stars. So how close are we? You know, what are the chances? Are we really on our way to the stars? What do you think, Stephen? Is human destiny wrapped up in eventually traveling to the stars? Is it something that's likely to happen? Is it something that you think we'll be working on in our lifetimes? What's your take on that?
Yes, I do believe that it's human destiny, but I have a rather broad definition of human.
Fair enough.
I do not believe that humans with bodies like ours are going to make the trip from one star to the next. Not based on the laws of the universe as we understand them today. Certainly, if it turns out the finding of Higgs boson means that that's all of a sudden we can do faster than light travel, all these assumptions that we have about the universe are overturned and we're able to do all these neat things, then, great. Let's make the Starship Enterprise and go and let's have a good time the way Kirk did. I do not believe that's the way it's going to happen. I believe that we will voyage throughout the galaxy, but it's going to be much different. We'll use something that was thought about by a gentleman by the name of von Neumann. He called what he came up with von Neumann probes. They were actually named for him. I don't think.
Yeah, they've been named. He called it it's actually his original idea was the Universal Assembler, I believe.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
And I guess that probably the we think of the most, or the, that we would connect with the most as far as a von Neumann probe, would be those monoliths from 2001, Space Odyssey, and the sequel. That was Arthur C. Clarke's idea of a von Neumann probe sent by an alien civilization to our solar system. So, it's, you know, were the aliens really there? Well, yeah, they were, in the sense that they, you know, that that machine, the monolith, was them. But their physical bodies are probably back home circling another star. So that's the von Neumann probe.
You know, and we'll come back to von Neumann probes in a minute, because I think that I think you're right. I think that those are the way we will get to interstellar space, in the same way that probes like Voyager and Pioneer are how we got to the planets so far, right?
Yeah.
We've never yet sent a human being anywhere farther away than the moon. It's pretty astounding. We got that far, and even lately, when we go to the moon, we don't send a person. And as we discussed a few weeks ago when we were talking about this new gold rush in space, all the commercial activity that is getting ready to start in space will all be done in an automated way, in a very von Neumann-esque way. So there's a lot to be said for the argument that our future in space generally, and our future particularly in interstellar space, is not a future for mostly original substrate humans, right? It's a future for our machines and for whatever they might evolve into. But I want to stick with the idea of actually building starships and sending people into space just for a moment before we come back to von Neumann probes. I was reading today. I remember there was some big there were big headlines about the 100-year starship project a while back, and that project is kind of an up and running thing. One of the things I like about it is I think they've got the time frame down right. If we're going to talk about all of the technology that we need to put together to send people into interstellar space, it's going to take it's a big project. It's going to take some time to make all that technology happen. Now, the problem with making 100-year plans for people like us, for people who look at the future the way we do, is you've got this kind of major interrupting event potentially happening somewhere in the middle of that 100 years, and then all bets are off. We might find we're no longer interested in interstellar space, or we might find that, oh yeah, post-singularity, we can build as many starships as we want, and they can go a lot faster than we ever thought, and it'll be really easy to send even just, you know, whales into space, you know, any big biological creature that we want to send into space. But putting the singularity aside, this is the right approach. They are taking kind of an Apollo approach to journeying to the stars, and they're saying, well, the first thing we have to do is we need to define all the problems that have to be solved, and we have to talk about what are the most viable ways of addressing those problems. Then we have to start developing that technology. We have to find commercially viable reasons for that technology to exist, and we have to create a context in which interstellar travel can be something that's viable and attractive and appealing, and that will take place. I mean, there, you know, even if you solve the technological problems, there are still huge, huge hurdles to sending people on that kind of trip, not least of which is it takes so long, right? But
it's a one-way trip. You know, it would be a generational ship. You don't take off on that trip and think that you'll ever return to Earth. You would take off on that trip and hope that one day your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren would see another star. That's a huge commitment. I mean, I don't know. You know,
that is a big commitment.
I even have some questions as to, is it even ethical to make that choice for your children and your unborn children and unborn grandchildren? You know, they never get to see the planet of their origin. You know, I mean, that's kind of tough.
Absolutely, it is. And assuming you can only go, say, 10, 20, 30% of the speed of light, And when I say only go that speed, I mean that's an incredibly fast speed to be traveling, according to anything we've ever done up to this point. But assuming you can only achieve those kinds of speeds, you'd be talking about a long, long, long trip. Now, it's possible that there are other intervening technologies that might help us out there. Maybe people can be shut down for a period of time and then brought back. We talk about cryonics as a potential life extension, life saving technology. But it's possible that something like that might be eventually implemented to allow a person to, well, the term that's used in science fiction is, you know, suspended animation, right? That a person might be able to shut themselves down and essentially not experience time while they're taking the trip. Also, if you get close enough to light speed, time slows down for you, and you get the benefit of time dilation. Now, in both of those instances, you're still going to have this adjustment. If you make, you know, if it's not a one-way trip, if you then do come back, you're coming back to a world that is far in the future from the world that you left. So that's going to be that's going to be very jarring and disconcerting for whoever makes the trip. But at least you wouldn't have that issue of making that long-term intergenerational commitment, assuming some technology like that could be worked out. Were we talking about this before the show started? It seemed like you had said something in reference to that.
Talking about the generational.
Actually, talking about suspended animation. I thought there was a tie-in with.
Yeah. It's something you see a lot of these days in science fiction. Most recently, I guess, and I don't guess I'm giving away too much about the movie to say that Prometheus, one of the things shown in the movie Prometheus is suspended animation for the duration of the space flight. That's something you see a lot. The movie Avatar had the same thing. I guess the both Alien and Aliens showed that.
Right.
You leave on one of these trips, you get into one of these pod things, and you take a good long nap. That's something you see a lot in science fiction. And, there's some evidence that, we could probably do that. We could probably figure out ways to do that safely. And that's a problem that's actually being worked on.
And so, you know, and no doubt that's one of the items that they're looking at on the 100-year Starship project. I just happened to find this. It's a really cool PDF. It's linked over at the Speculist. Of a talk, an internal talk at NASA about the possibilities of traveling to the stars, and we don't have time to get into all these different ideas that were proposed. But these guys talked about solar sails, and they talked about that is kind of the near term thing. Ultimately, there's a schematic in here for a matter antimatter engine, which would make Mr. Scott very happy, I believe. And then they talk about discovering new laws of physics, basically. They talk about unknown unknowns, things that might fall into our perceptual understanding over the next few years that will open up new ways of thinking about how we can travel into interstellar space. And swinging this back around to our discussion at the beginning, it's possible that nailing down the Higgs boson or something like it might ultimately push us in that direction. But it's great to see it from NASA, because obviously the NASA folks think in terms of macro technology. They don't think about nanotech, and they don't think about sending a Coke-sized can, a Coke can-sized probe to Alpha Centauri to find metal that it can use to build another Coke can-sized probe to send off to the next star system, so forth. You know, they're thinking about huge ships. There's one of the pictures shows a solar sail that would be required to fly this starship, and for reference, they show the solar sail next to the moon. And it's about a third the size, right? So we're talking about some truly massive engineering that would be required to make something like that happen. And you don't have to be post singularity, but you have to have some very advanced technology for some of these kinds of things to happen. Still very cool, I think, that people are talking about them and thinking about them. But I think to swing it back around to your earlier point, in the near term or the relative near term, the economical way to do it, the quick way to do it, is going to be something like an unmanned probe. And assuming that we get that we make the progress that we're hoping to make in both nanotechnology and artificial intelligence, something like self-replicating von Neumann probes using nanotechnology, using artificial intelligence, seem like the right way to explore the universe.
Absolutely. It's the difference between sending what, and I said this in a much earlier show, but imagine how big a ship would have to be to be a generation starship. Obviously, you're not going to send one or two people on a generation starship. It's going to be basically a small town worth of people. And then, you know, you just imagine how big it would need to be. We're talking like the amount of mass involved would be similar to perhaps one of the Hawaiian Islands. Okay, we're talking something that big versus the Coke can that we were talking about, the small probe that would, you know, in effect be the intelligent machine that would then go and replicate and perhaps, you know, maybe does it carry the genetic code of all the life on Earth when it goes and when it gets to Alpha Centauri, find a suitable place to set down and begin propagating life. You know, who knows what we'd be interested in doing when we reach the point that we have the technology that would allow us to do those sort of things. Maybe that wouldn't interest us at all. But you know, that's the sort of thing you're talking about.
Well, I should say George Dvorsky wrote a piece on this, like 4 years ago now, called Seven Ways to Control the Galaxy with Self-Replicating Probes. And I know we've talked about this piece he wrote. It's a really, really cool essay he wrote, two or three times over the last few years. But I'll just mention it again because I think what George does here is great in terms of breaking down the different uses you could put these kinds of probes to. He talks about exploration probes. They're just going out to do exactly what Voyager and Pioneer did, to find out what's there and send us information back. Then communication probes would be out there to look for extraterrestrial intelligence, look for other intelligence, and talk to them, establish communication with them. He talks about sending out worker probes to do mega-scale engineering projects like Dyson spheres and ring worlds, colonization probes. Now, this is this goes to the idea that you just suggested. Possibly we load genetic information into there, and it could be Project Genesis, right? We could find a dead moon out there, and we could bring it to life with the encoded information and enough organic material to get life started. The other thing you can do is you can upload, assuming technology gets to this point where human consciousness can be uploaded, and you could actually have your small town inside your Coke can and talk about suspended animation, right? You could just not even activate it until they get to the first destination, right? So even if it takes 100 years, 150 years, 10,000 years to get wherever you're going, the quote-unquote people, the consciousnesses inside, you know, they're just completely inactive until they get there, until there's something to see. And then once they're there, boom, they wake up and they can interact with that environment in any way that they choose. It's a really profound thought to think that, you could encapsulate a large cross-section of our entire civilization and have that replicated and have that sent throughout the galaxy. I'm not sure I know for what purpose, right? Although I'm intrigued by the idea. I love the idea of uploading myself into the computer substrate and having, you know, tens of thousands or millions of copies of Phil exploring the galaxy, right? And each one showing up at a different planet and learning something, and then eventually maybe somehow we all get back together and we share all those memories. But in that instance, you get the best of both worlds, don't you? Because you use the nanotechnology, you use the self-replication, you use the artificial intelligence as the means of getting there, but ultimately you have that experience of sending ourselves, truly, in some sense ourselves, out into the universe. And absolutely, we're a long way from that, but we've made at least one step in that direction as of Voyager making this incredible step this week.
Absolutely. And I guess I'm having this picture of the 2001 Space Odyssey towards the end, where it gets weird, and the astronaut finally meets up with these aliens. At that point, I think the filmmaker kind of threw his hands up and goes, you know, how do we people of normal and normal human intelligence, how do we show aliens that have, as we do? He just said, well, the best we can do is just sort of do something that's representative, because we don't have a clue. And so then you end up with things like the European-looking, Baroque-looking room, and the Star Child, I think they were doing representative theater at that point. Who knows? When we reach that point, we're able to do that. We're so far beyond where we are at now. The way we look at the universe, our motivations may be different. I'm still hopeful, though, that we'll be explorers and we'll be interested in learning as much as we can about the universe around us. And so
Since you keep coming back to 2001, one of the possibilities that that George mentions there is actually that of the Uplift probe, where we become the aliens, right, who send the monolith out, right, where we go out there and we find primitive life or civilization that's just beginning. It's kind of like the polar opposite of Star Trek and the Prime Directive, right, but where we find worthy-looking life and say, here, how would you like to share in our civilization? We're going to take you up to the next level, like the aliens do with the apes at the beginning of 2001, A Space Odyssey. And then once we're into space, they take us up to that next level and turn Dave Bowman into the baby with the big eyes, right? They're at the end of the movie. Now, that could be us, not only explorers, but this hugely, we would hope, positive force in the universe, helping all of the universe to realize its potential.
Arthur C. Clarke described it in his book. He describes it, these great intelligences having explored the galaxy, have never found anything quite as beautiful as the mind.
Right.
So they busy themselves cultivating mind. That's basically what they're doing. And so that's interesting. I think that's an interesting motivation to imagine that these greater than human intelligences would have, and may not be far from the truth.
A worthy possible future for us, cultivating the mind out among the stars. All right, we'll have to leave it at that. And what's our music this evening?
The music tonight is Vehicle by Woodfish.
Vehicle, perfect name for a song for tonight's show. Woodfish singing Vehicle. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. And thank you all for being with us. We'll be back next week at the normal time. Our guest will be Colin McInnes talking about bringing dead matter to life. So you won't want to miss that. We look forward to being with you all then. And until next time, live to see it.
Back in my young days.